I'm Lawrence Francis, host of Interpreting Wine, the place to learn from thought leaders in the world of wine and marketing, welcoming you to the MW Student Series. Across these four episodes, exploring the personal and professional experiences of four current MW students with the aim to shine a light on the varied roles each has within the wine industry. And in each episode, we'll also be tasting a selection of wines that have a special significance to each guest. We continue the series in the company of Luke Harbour, head sommelier of The Pig in the South Downs. His episode is a brilliant exploration of his entry into the wine industry, developing and working his way through various roles in the company to his current position. Luke completed the WSET diploma in 2020 and subsequently qualified as a WSET educator, leading the PIGS wine education program across the group. More recently, he was awarded the IWSC's Prize for Emerging Talent in Hospitality in April 2021 and started the Master of Wine program in September 2021. We caught up a couple of months into his journey, and Luke begins telling us his origin story before taking us on a deep dive into the various properties in the PIG group. We talked seasonality in food and wine, discussed the impact of COVID on the staff and the guests, before tasting a wine specially selected by Luke, the Danbury Ridge Estate Chardonnay 2018, for which he also suggests some pairings from the various PIG menus. And we close off our conversation talking about his experiences of the MW program so far, and look ahead through the lens of the recently planted vineyard at The Pig in the South Downs. Enjoy.
I have always enjoyed and I've found the world of hospitality fascinating, and I suppose I didn't really fall into wine. It was more of a molding into wine via a few different occasions. I don't think there was one light bulb occasion where I tasted a wine and thought, okay, this is my trajectory and my career pathway. It was a series of events that has probably led me to my role now and the capacity I work within now and study. But it really all started, I mean, I've always enjoyed working. I've always had a pocket money earner since a paper round, moving into, you know, a few cafes and pubs. And the hospitality side gripped me in, I think. I didn't follow the academic university pathway. Pure choice, I suppose. And not really having an end goal in sight at university. So I decided to steer in the hospitality goal and see the many sides of our industry, from the bar to the front of house service to even the back of house as well. Wine was a topic that, whilst I was working at a place called the Coombe House Hotel, the proprietor at the time, Ken, he was a wonderful guy, and he had a sheer passion and commitment, interest, hobby, and semi-addiction, I suppose, to drinking fine wine. And he was very generous. And throughout my days at Coombe House, he would be the one that would always sort of open up a bottle at the end of the evening. I mean, at the time, I wasn't aware of the kind of caliber of wines he was opening. They were obviously tasty and pleasurable wines to him more so, but I was hooked by his intrigue in these wines, the way he would string a sentence together, how he would talk about these wines were so dear to his heart. And I suppose that helped as the gateway into, okay, this is interesting. There must be something more than just a fermented beverage here. So he was the one that suggested, okay, you should try and do a wine course or something that gives you a bit of a framework to learning more about wine than just opening a few corks and tasting, which of course is one of the best ways. But having something to ground onto and a sort of a framework of learning sort of helps steer the direction. So I suppose the entry into wine was hospitality. It was the interest via the old proprietor of the Hotel Ken. And that's it, really. I mean, I don't have any family in the wine industry, very much far from the wine industry. My parents, I'm steering them towards loving wine, but it's never been a big part of our family life. So it's definitely stemmed from my career than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And I think it's a theme really that keeps coming up and it's come up several times really in the podcast is really around generosity around fine wines. And, you know, I just think it's interesting that, you know, you pointed to Ken his propensity to share wines with you. And I just think that's just such an important part. And I think it's almost kind of built into the fabric as well, you know, sharing wines, explaining wines to each other, and maybe there's that kind of informal learning, which I think as you say has been the propulsion, and then you've gone down the formal route to kind of back that up and give it some structure.
Exactly that. I think you're right. I mean, generosity is something that we use in my current profession all the time with the hotel I work for. But in the industry, I mean, there has been no greater sense of generosity through the years that I've worked in the industry than time, bottles. I mean, you know, it's a real sense of it's a gratifying sense, I suppose. You know, sharing something with others that excites others and propels interest is what I love. It all started there. So I suppose after that that sinker, you know, I where I was working at the time, Coombe House, there was the announcement of the closure. Ken and Ruth, Ruth being Ken's wife, they sold the business, and they sold the business to the Pig Hotels. So the Pig Hotels are a group of hotels based in the south of England, steered by a guy called Robin Hudson, who early in his pathway, founded Hotel de Vannes with the late and great Gerard Basset. So wine has always been in the DNA of Robin and the hotels. So when it came to the closure of the hotel, I vividly remember having a conversation with Robin and our operations director, Tom, about potentially staying on with the group, and if so, in what capacity. And it felt like such a sort of right move, a easy move to do, was being offered a place as a sommelier for the Pigs, a trainee sommelier working under a head sommelier and an assistant, and really learning the ropes, learning the art of service, learning the art of the cellar, and just purely learning about wine. Nothing else. My role was purely focused on textbooks and tasting, and that's all it was. And was one of the best times. I mean, it was fantastic. So that was the gateway in, really. I left Coombe House and I took a job for the Pigs, and that's when it started becoming apparent that you really could build a career pathway excuse me, not just in hospitality, but in the wine field. And as you keep digging, you know, the world opens up to what you can achieve in this this wine world. So it started there. I moved to one of our hotels called the Pig on the Beach at Studland Bay, and from there I worked with a very classical sommelier, a guy, a French sommelier called Mederic, had very classical ways of working. His selections, his choices on the wine list certainly reflected his journey, his personality, and where he'd come from. He was from Beaujolais. And I owe him a lot. I mean, he taught me a huge deal on the greats of the world and the classical wine regions of the world. And it really sparked the interest. I mean, he is learned and enjoyed wine all of his life, and passed on lots of that information, of course, opened many bosses along the way. So shortly followed a stint for the Pig on the Beach. I opened the Pig at Coombe. So while they were doing the restoration on the hotel, I worked at the Pig on the Beach and then moved back to the Pig at Coombe for the opening of the new Pig, which was a fantastic experience. I worked under an Italian sommelier, Selene, who now is actually my partner, and that was quite a great experience as well. I learned so much in a different capacity, should we say, less potentially the sort of scientific and the geeky side of wine, but I gained a great deal on the cultural side of wine and where it fits where it fits in on the table in an Italian household. So that was fantastic. And from there, I stepped up. Selene left the hotel to pursue her own undertakings, and I stepped into the role of head sommelier for the Pig at Coombe. And that's where I went on to study the WSET diploma. And that was a couple of years of my life, really, working for the Pig at Coombe and then studying the diploma whilst there, which is immensely challenging, but equally very rewarding. And that sort of set me up for the next opening, which was the Pig at Bridge Place in Kent. And that really opened the gateway for English wine. It was quite an experience there, what we've achieved to date so far with our connection and ties with the Wine Guild of England and English wines in general. And then coming very recently, we have just opened a new hotel in the South Downs, the Pig in the South Downs, just outside of Arundel, Maidhurst. And there we have planted our own vineyard. We're a very wine-focused hotel. Mm. We have a large wine team, which is brilliant. And we've even planted a small vineyard as well at the hotel. So that's been an immense opportunity to be involved with.
Super interesting to hear. A story that's contracted really into such a short space, and I'm sure there's loads to unpick, and I'm sure there's loads that will come out really in the rest of our conversation. But I think that being as the Pig hotels have been such a huge influence on your career and your life, I would say it would be really great to kind of get the sort of 30,000 foot view of the group and where they are, but then also maybe talking a little bit about the differences between the different hotels and the different styles that they kind of bring forward, which you've already hinted at as part of your journey and your learning evolution.
Absolutely. So all the hotels have immense personality. They are all autonomous to each property. Should I say, actually, each property has autonomy over most of its curiosity. So the food menu is based on the local location, 25 miles. We try and source most of our produce. The wine list is curated by each head sommelier across the Pig, so we have no group buying. Each bar list and cocktail list is crafted by the bartender and the head bartenders of the hotel. So you really get a sense of personality in each of the hotels. You feel, you could walk into one of these hotels and you would know it's a Pig, but you're in a very different style of property. They all operate under a slightly different regime, and that's all steered by the hotel director. So we have, just as a general overview, there are now 8 hotels spread across the southern part of England, ranging from Cornwall to Dorset, Devon, Hampshire, Sussex now, and Kent. So 8 hotels across the group, and the South Downs being our latest property. They are considered a restaurant with rooms. So we are a kitchen garden based restaurant with produce coming straight from the kitchen garden every morning. And then utilizing whatever's in the local area. So whether you're on the Cornish coast, or you're sort of in the Mendips, in the Pignit Bath, and you're utilizing the deer park surrounding the hotel, they all, I suppose just to go over. So autonomy at each of the properties is really important. That really is why, a huge part of why they've been so successful, I suppose. There is, it's not a cookie cutter model. There's a bit of overlap, but not a huge amount. So every experience is kind of different across the group. And that's quite refreshing. It's not often, I suppose, you see a group of the size with 8 different wine lists, 8 different food menus, 8 different cocktail lists, etc. And they all have a different feeling. They're all charming historical buildings. The Pig at Coombe is an Elizabethan house. The Pig on the Beach is this beautiful castle-like sort of Harry Potter feel castle on the edge of the cliff overlooking the Isle of Wight and Old Harry's Rocks. The Pig at Bridge Place is this sort of Jacobean manor that was a rock and roll paradise back in the 60s and 70s with people like Led Zeppelin and the Kinks playing at this hotel. So they're from just the building itself, they have a different feel to the hotels. Some are grander, some are more intimate and perhaps more romantic. Some are energetic and lively. So that steers the feel of the hotel. And then, of course, once you're there, the people make the feeling of the hotel. So the input from the hotel director is definitely felt. Their sense of how a hotel should run and the personality is felt. And then the experience that you have through the door is really down to the people. And that's what makes the differences. I almost feel like, dare I say it, they are great in different seasons and different times of the year. I would opt for something like the Pig on the Beach in the middle of summer. I mean, it's a busy property. It's got a great feeling. There's a buzziness to the hotel. But I would be going there in summer. Like I say, it's on the edge of a cliff there. It's beautiful. It has an outside wood-fired oven. And I just think about rosé and the Pig on the Beach and kind of having a good time, you know, sharing a glass of something with friends. So I would say, that's a really fun property. The Pig at Coombe, it has this sort of autumnal winter feel. It's grand. You have a mile and a half driveway. It feels like you should be there in the kind of evening when it's getting dark earlier and it's cold outside and the fires are roaring. And I think of the classics with Coombe. The wine list, it's always been quite a classical list. We have a really, I think, a really excellent selection of Bordeaux, Burgundy, of Tuscany, etc. And it does feel like it should be a sort of heart of or also middle of winter property. Moving over to somewhere like Kent, the Pig at Bridge Place, we're surrounded by the Wine Garden of England and, you know, the main, along with Sussex and I suppose a bit of Essex, the epicenter of English wine. So the list is primarily focused on those fantastic producers within 25 miles of the property, you know, give or take. I mean, maybe expand to sort of 30, 40 miles, but that list is really, the emphasis shines on English wine, both still and sparkling. So you can expect a huge range poured both by the glass and by the bottle of wines from England or the UK, and a variety of price points as well, from sort of mid price point tiers up to the, or going on to the premium, and dare I say it, the super premium wines now from England. So that's a very unique point there. And then if you came down to Sussex, you'd have a great snapshot of what's happening in Sussex for sparkling wines. Moving Sussex has been eye-opening to see the quality-driven focus of sparkling wine producers. So you could definitely expect to see even a rotation of sparkling wines every few months on that list. The Pig at Harlem Bay in Cornwall, they have a lobster shed. I'd be there in sort of spring, summer, Lobster, they've got a great wine list. Yeah. Our head som Greg, he's put an immense wine list together, both for the hotel and for the Lobster Shed. I'd be thinking either really great English Chardonnay or some Burgundy and Lobster. I mean, quite decadent, I suppose. But that would be a small snapshot of some of the differences within the hotels.
And if you haven't used it already, then I might trademark "There's a pig for every season."
I like that. No, we haven't used it. Get onto marketing straight away.
I love it. Yeah, I love that. I love that kind of tour. And I think as you sort of zoomed down there a little bit from the sort of 30,000 views. So we're starting to pick out those different details of the different properties. But I like, and again, what's coming across to me though is that there will be, as any sort of, I think, quality restaurant, for example, that goes with seasonality, there'll be seasonality, I presume, also in the wine list as well. And just in terms of being in tune with what's happening more widely as well, and what's likely to be on the plate, that's also got a strong influence on what's going to be in the glass.
Most certainly, most certainly. Our wine list, as I mentioned, autonomous to the hotels, and I think that there is no, of course, set in stone approach. But we all have that sense of seasonality, certainly with the food, and that of course reflects in the wine list and. Probably most notably by the glass. So throughout the seasons, we're rotating the by the glass selection to really homogenize and work with our menu. Our menu is forever changing. It changes on a daily basis. But of course, with the seasons, it dramatically changes, which means we have the opportunity to be presenting wines of that season. I think it's a great thing to do. I mean, throughout the summer, you can imagine the wines are slightly lighter, they're fresher, they're crisper. Even the service temperatures slightly change. I've just changed the temperatures on our red wine fridges now because, in the summer, it's lovely to have a slightly cooler service temperature on red wines and potentially whites as well. And then going into the winter, maybe you come up a degree or two on your red wines. So there's a lot of seasonality in the wines by the glass, and then the list is constantly evolving just based on curiosity and working with, we work with an abundance of brilliant importers and distributors and suppliers. So we're forever changing the wine list, and that's part of the beauty of the wine industry. You can never taste enough.
Amazing. And I think, it would be... I think interesting, and I think what I'd like to also share with the listeners as well. Towards the end of 2020, I produced the Hospitality Summit, where I was talking to people from a range of places within the hospitality industry about the impacts of the pandemic, and I actually think that it would be interesting to touch on that with you, really, and talk about. That all of the things that you've spoken about really have been around welcoming people there and having that interaction and for so long last year and for I believe parts of this year as well earlier on that wasn't possible and I just wonder if maybe with a little bit of distance perhaps between yourself and that now you can maybe just reflect on the impacts of that time on yourself and on the wider group.
I think that's a good word, reflection. I mean, this the pandemic has certainly given us a lot of time to reflect. We've always tried to stay connected since day one of the pandemic, when the doors were being closed. Connectivity was so important for us, both with our teams and with our guests. From day one, it was really important that we could keep the conversation alive, keep the discussion alive. The hotels were still sort of churning away in the background. I mean, the kitchen gardens were still happening. The season was still happening. So there was work being done in the hotels. And we were utilizing the time to try and engage with tastings, with online discussion, with just general bits and pieces, just general fun. I mean, we were doing quizzes every week. And I think that was really important to try and keep everyone, have a bit of motivation there, because it was sort of really demoralizing. I mean, it was deflating times, and mm-hmm. no one quite knew what was around the corner. But I must admit, I mean, you know, there's always been a sense of camaraderie and sort of mm-hmm. safety behind working for the group from day one. I mean, from day one, even when we had no idea what was going on, the group has always been looking after their teams. So that, you know, we did host a few wine tastings, both for our teams and for our guests. We put a series of mixed cases together, working with both our suppliers and English producers. And then we would host a few Zoom calls. You know, we would send a case of wine out like a few others. And they were quite successful. I mean, we had a few hundred people on the call, which was superb, just to see a few faces and again try and keep that discussion alive. And of course, you know, share the message of what was going on in the hotel and trying to promote a sense of a positivity with welcoming our guests back. So you know, last year very stop and start, and this year as well, that was very tricky. I mean, packing these hotels down and opening them doesn't happen overnight. There's a huge amount of sort of like infrastructural work that has to take place, and big decisions. But it's, gosh, it's been a whirlwind. Like if I think back, it's been a blast really. But opening up this year, was a great sense of achievement to open the doors. And it's not often you get to open a hotel twice. So looking at it with a silver lining, you know, we had the opportunity to rethink how we did things or how we do things. We had the opportunity to look at our wine list with a fine tooth comb and brush through all of those service points, and use the time for staff training. And so that was the positive element, is, you know, we had to open the hotel twice. And like I said, you know, it just doesn't come around. So that was the positive spin. And getting people back through the door never felt so good. And engaging in conversation on a face-to-face basis felt great. And it still feels brilliant. I mean, you know, there is, of course, a fine balance with what's going on. And we, you know, proceed with absolute caution where we need to. But we want it to feel welcoming, homely, you know. We don't want it to feel like a hostile environment. When you come into the pig, you're there to take your hat off and, you know, relax into a sofa. And that's the atmosphere we're still trying to create. So it has been challenging. There has, of course, been great challenges for the group. But on a positive way, I would suggest that, you know, our teams are still super engaged. We've had the opportunity to not reinvent, but certainly reshape our thinking on some respects. And I think we're in a stronger position for it now. So yeah, that's a whistle stop of where we are now.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing. Cause I think, you know, it's important to reflect on, you know, what the pandemic has brought us, but yeah, also maybe what it's taught us as well. And as you say, it sounds as though, you know, you have seen the silver lining in a way, and actually taken that time to make the pig and what it does even better. What I'd actually like to move us to now, Luke, is really something that I think will certainly excite me, and I think will really bring together a lot of different elements of your story, which is actually to taste a wine which I asked you before, obviously, to choose and really wanted to invite you to bring something on to the podcast, you know, that you felt a particular passion for, very excited to see a still wine from England, which is again, I think, you know, still one of those things that we're all discovering and we're sort of really finding out about, really, you know, following the success of sparkling English wine. So I would just invite you really to guide us through maybe a little bit the choice of the wine itself, and then, you know, before actually then, you know, taking us into the glass and talking about, you know, this particular wine that you've chosen.
Of course. So just to set the context, the English wine scene, I think, is absolutely the most exciting it's ever been before. And it's been fascinating to sort of be at the forefront and the vanguard of this emerging wine industry. At the Pigs, we've always championed English wine ever since 2014. You know, we've suppressed champagne for English sparkling. And over the course of the past few years, the category has expanded both in quantity and in quality. And we're really starting to see every year different journeys and different stories emerge. So the wine that we've chosen to taste today really reflects that sentiment. And the wine is from an estate in Essex named Danbury Ridge. And Danbury Ridge is at the very beginning of its journey in terms of wine production. So the wine you have in front of you, their estate Chardonnay, it comes from fruit that they grow in Essex. This is their very first wine. Danbury Ridge was founded by two generations of the Bunker family. So Michael and Heather Bunker and their daughters, Janine and Sophie. And they have an estate in Essex outside of Chelmsford. And they first planted in 2014. And they have a real focus on, you know, high quality Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, with clones planted to sort of exploit their unique climate. And I became aware of the estate by two people, and one of them is a guy named Liam. I hope I'm not pronouncing his name incorrectly, but Liam Idiskowski, who was previously at Lime Bay Winery, I sort of met Liam a few years ago with another connection, and then John Atkinson, who is a master of wine, who used to consult for Billy Cart Salmon, and now sort of consults for Danbury Ridge, and I've had the sort of honor to be with them from day one. Liam was very much involved and spearheading the new winery design, and they've built a brand new winery from scratch, sort of state of the art. And then following John in his viticultural footsteps. So we spent countless hours in the vineyards talking all things soils, rootstocks, clonal selection, and then pruning, which is quite dear to John's heart, being a cool climate viticultural specialist. So that's how I sort of became aware of the wines, and I've tasted them from sort of day one in barrel and in tank to where we are today, which is tasting the first vintage in bottle with now some good time in bottle as well. In terms of the actual wine, this is a Burgundy model Chardonnay fermented in oak barrels. Matured in oak barrels, what it struck me as one of the most compelling and exciting wines to emerge from the UK. So, from a tasting perspective, you know, I'm always hesitant to cite tasting notes to a wine. It's very individual, but I mean, you know, purely in the glass, it's it is something of a Burgundy model Chardonnay. It has this wonderful sort of orange blossom, a kind of tangerine skin character. It has an oak quality, but an integrated oak quality. You know, I think the freshness and the acidity is, you know, prominent with these wines, but it's not overbearing. I actually think it's a beauty from English wine is the freshness. And then what struck me about this wine was its sense of wholeness and togetherness and its length. I mean, it has excellent length. And I was, purely blown away by its structural elements coming from England, you know, tasting the Chardonnay and thinking, wow, okay, you know, this has it all. It has a combination of aromatics. It has textural weight. It has really good freshness. You know, it would be lovely to see this wine in a few years' time, purely for the fact that we haven't really tasted any English Chardonnays with any bottle age. So this coming from an excellent year, 2018 was cited as a wonderful year in England with great ripeness. It would be lovely to see it lie down and see where it goes, see the evolution of this wine. In terms of a pairing on our menu, we always like to steer the conversation with, you know, what sort of dish it, or what sort of wine do you prefer? We do our recommendations on food in preference to, you know, what a guest likes. So we would never try and dictate that you must have a Chardonnay with a bit of fish, because that's the sort of classical example of a pairing. We always try and work out, you know, what the guest enjoys first. So if they enjoy a New Zealand style Sauvignon Blanc or a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, they probably wouldn't like a richer, fuller style of Chardonnay. So therefore, you know, therefore we wouldn't tailor that style. But based on this wine, I think, you know, how I would suggest this in a restaurant setting is the curiosity of it being, you know, the first vintage. You know, you get a snapshot view of the very first vintage of this wine. It's certainly one of the highest quality still Chardonnays in the UK, and it would definitely be benchmarked in a blind tasting, I'm sure, with other, you know, top end counterparts on the continent or further afield, perhaps somewhere like Oregon. You know, it is a charming wine, and I think there are multiple ways you could look at pairing this wine, from classics to maybe slightly obscure. I mean, you know, a firm favorite would be going something like our Tomahawk of Pork Chop, which is brined, slightly cured inside. Then it's done on our Josper sort of open fire grill. And it's just finished with greens and a mustard, whole grain mustard sauce. I mean, I think it'd be a wonderful pairing. You know, for fish, it feels like you should go for some sort of, you know, the king of the sea, or something like turbot or lobster, if you like, because it deserves it. It celebrates it. It's not afraid of being, it's not afraid of being a premium wine. And then quite simply, I mean, you know, the other beauty, you could enjoy this with some crackling, for instance. You know, yeah, it could really work with food. And I think food is a brilliant element to bring into the equation. And of course works in harmony. But actually, do you need food with the wine? I've never quite understood the needing food with the wine, except maybe huge tannic examples from Italy, perhaps. But I think this has a place on its own as well. You know, a good glass, let's bring in like a fancy glass, like a Zalto, a good setting, you know, by the fire or something, and some crackling. I mean, superb. That would be my go-to, and just enjoy the wine, reflect on the wine, look at what can be achieved in such a short amount of time from this bottle of wine. And I cannot wait to see the next few vintages that Danbury Ridge will show.
Amazing. Thank you. It's so nice to have the luxury really of the time to hear you kind of unpack all of that story. And this was a particularly interesting bottle for me to open this morning. You know, seeing the 2018 on there, knowing what a phenomenal year that was, and how warm that was, and that ripeness. And I think that was the thing that surprised me the most. Upon opening, it was actually the amount of ripeness that I found there. You know, I think that maybe it may just be my own mind, but you know, maybe there is sometimes a bit of a laziness around English wine, and you just say, oh, it's acid, and kind of really focus in and kind of overplay that point, really. And again, for me, it was all of the things that you've mentioned there, you know, the words that came to mind as I was tasting it this morning, you know, was mouthfeel, was kind of quite a broad, almost luscious flavor and characteristic coming through, and it totally makes sense, I think, as you know, as I sort of learned more from yourself around the production and the sort of style that they're trying to make here. And I just equally excited to see either more from the estate or indeed where these vines and where this particular wine and where maybe some of those single plot vinifications kind of go in off into the future. But this is absolutely phenomenal. And I don't know how much has been produced, but I definitely recommend that if you're listening and this sounds like your sort of thing, seeking this out, because how often do you get to try the first wine from a new producer and above all, one that's from here and one that's English and maybe one that will surprise a few people. So I almost feel like this would be an interesting one to take along to a party or with your sommelier friends if they're into blind tasting and see if they pick this as an English Chardonnay.
For sure, I couldn't agree more. I think tasting this with a bunch of people that have an interesting wine or not an interesting wine, just want a glass of something delicious would equally be entertaining.
Yeah,
but I believe a meager amount has been made. I think it was around 888 bottles produced in the first vintage. So tiny quantities. And that's the blessing in disguise, I suppose, with England is that our yields are tiny. But also that's the beauty. Mm-hmm. I mean, tuck a case away, put it away, put a couple of bottles aside and see what happens in a few years. I mean, the dream would be in 6 years' time, we can taste a case from every vintage from 2018 and, reflect with the team at the winery, with John, with Liam, with the Bunker family, what's happened there, what's happened within those 6 years. And then look to the future, I guess. Just a point on price, this does sit within a premium category within the wine list. You could, an alternative on the wine list would be something at a village level Burgundy, whether it's Pulini or Meursault, or a Premier Cru in the South. This does sit in within that category. So, there was always a bit of caution when we first put the wines on the list and we realized that they would sit at that price point on the list. I would say it was a bit of an unknown field of, would it be successful? Would there be the interest? Would there be disappointment when you tasted the wine? Burgundy has such a name, of course, and reputation and deservedly so. So, where does this first bottle of English wine that, there's 800 bottles produced and it's made in Essex, where does that fit on the list? And we were not hesitant, that's the wrong word, but we were curious. But the complete opposite, the probably our first imagination, it's been unbelievably successful. We've pretty much sold all of our allocation across the group of this wine. And the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive and I think it really has sparked an element of curiosity and assumption that, English wine really can, in the right vintage with the right tools and the right site, can be world class. And that's what's been fascinating to see as well.
Luke, really enjoyed the wine and I think, fantastic choice. And really, I think, has really unpacked for me that idea of you being a great advocate for English wine and I'm sure this is and will encourage quite a few people listening to dust off or to unpack one of those cases or bottles of English wine that they may have in their cellar. Where I'd actually like to take the conversation now is actually towards the MW program, simply because everybody that I'm having on in the series is actually an MW student. And I think that is going to be an interesting way to kind of, tie really, all of the experiences that you've spoken about in with, an experience that's mainly ahead of you now still in terms of the MW. So, I wonder if we couldn't sort of pick up the story really in terms of the transition. You already have the diploma, which is, one of the highest wine awards out there. But what was it that made you want to, push yourself even further, really, and embark on the MW? And what has the journey been like so far?
It's always been in the back of my mind, and the goal whilst I was studying for the diploma is what's the next step. I love the rigor and the depth to the study of the diploma, and I enjoyed the I enjoyed the nature of studying. I mean, it was great. There was always something to work towards. Wine is such a vast topic, you can quite easily be sort of lost in a plethora of tangents, you know, picking up books here, there, and everywhere. So I love the focus that the diploma gave. And then the MW, I suppose it was always the balance between, do you go down the Master of Wine pathway or the Master Sommelier pathway? And it may be slightly strange that I haven't chosen the MS pathway based on my profession. But I have always been inspired by Masters of Wine. I've been lucky enough to taste with many Masters of Wine, and I've been lucky enough to participate in field days. And I've had the support as well through my diploma from various Masters of Wine. And one of my earliest experiences was with a Master of Wine named Liam Stevenson, who is now based in Bristol. And I was really sort of fascinated by the program. It's broad, it's expansive, it's daunting in a way, and you hear various different avenues into the Master of Wine program. But it, for me, it was the breadth, the rigor, and the way that the MW program is tackled and what they look for. It's always questioning why. It's being inquisitive at every stage. It's, you know, putting rational, focused, analytical impressions to every question you come across. And I think, you know, with the WSET, there's quite a lot of prescriptive work in there, which is great, but it's less based on opinion, and it's less based on sort of pulling your opinion together and then presenting a balanced argument for whatever topic you're discussing. And I liked that idea. You know, the MW, you have to bring real world examples to everything you do. You have to justify every point you make. Again, in that sort of analytical, logical, coherent way within quite a short space of paper. So I really like that idea of bringing lots of opinions to the table, utilizing my journey, getting to know producers, traveling, understanding the regions of the world, and then sort of fitting them together and then putting this like Rubik's Cube around putting an answer together and understanding a region. So sorry, that was a bit of a tangent, but MW versus MS, the fascination was, I've probably been influenced by Masters of Wine that I've worked with. I've found them always to be humble. I've found them to be generous with time, like a lot of those in the industry as well. But also not afraid to say they don't know. And, you know, maybe there's the idea of the Master of Wine must know everything. And, you know, there's no question that a Master of Wine doesn't know. I think that's actually... not true at all. I think, you know, the humbleness that I've seen from many Masters of Wine is saying, tackling the problem with, I could find out though, you know, this is how I would find out, or I will find out perspective, not sort of being too prescriptive. And that's what I've loved. So that's why I chose to look further into the Master of Wine program and what that entailed.
I think that for me reflects, really the stage that you're at. You know, I think it feels as though, you maybe had an important fork in the road in terms of, going down the MS path or the MW path. And I just wonder. I mean, you know, there may not be a direct connection, but do you see, maybe, yeah, from kind of from the outside and at a fairly early stage, but do you see that looping back into your career in a particular way, and maybe the evolution of where you see your career going as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think there are many avenues within the greater wine industry, and hospitality of one of those avenues. But of course, I would love to explore a different angle of the wine industry at some stage. I love what I do. I'm grateful that I can go to work and genuinely enjoy every day. But there are other avenues that I would like to explore. I find viticulture and winemaking fascinating. I find the business of wine quite compelling. I think it's interesting. I have niche topics that I sort of deep dive into that have really no reference into hospitality. But I suppose, that does link into the future pathway and building those or laying those stones out now for what's around the corner. And I think, the Master of Wine program enables you to have a broad view of most of the avenues of the wine industry. And there are masters of wine from every different angle. And I think that's also a real positive, is that you can collate information from so many different angles, whether it's buying, whether it's winemaking, the business, whether it's packaging. So I look forward to gaining experience from others way on a different path than I currently am.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I think it will also potentially help a lot of people out there. I feel as though there are lots of people who have done the diploma who I know a lot of them listen, and they're not sure about whether or not to even think about, I think, the MW program. So I really feel like you being still fairly early in your journey and sharing the thought process, I really think that will help a lot of people out there, just to revisit and think about whether or not they might want to have another look at the program. The time has really flown by, so I really just have one last question for you, and it's as usual a future oriented question, but I'll ask it in a slightly different way, actually, because I know from our pre-chat that you've been planting a vineyard at the new hotel. So I think it would be interesting, through the perspective of the vineyard, really, to look ahead and just to think about the vineyard's place in the world and in the restaurant, and I guess also what experiences and development experiences really that's going to bring to yourself and to your team and to the wider group.
The vineyard has been a fascinating topic to be involved with. When Robin suggested that we planted a vineyard at the new hotel, I was pretty ecstatic and wanted to be involved as much as possible. It's really starting from the very roots up, as it were, and making every decision we possibly could at every stage. And we're still at the very early doors. So maybe just, what does it bring to the hotel as such? It brings a kind of gateway into what we're trying to do. It's been such a useful tool for our guests to explore. We've done countless vineyard tours. Mm-hmm. We've done tastings. And I'm sure, as everyone listening knows, there's nothing better than being stood in a vineyard whilst tasting a glass, albeit not our wine just yet, but tasting a glass and sort of resonating, what we're trying to achieve. What's the goal of this vineyard? So it has been a brilliant tool to utilize with guests. It's something very unique to our hotels, and also for our team to use as a sort of educational tool to explain the vine cycle and the decisions that we have made and how they will be reflected in the future. So from day one, we tried to lean on our friends that we've sort of built relationships with over the past few years. So our friends in Kent, this Charles and Ruth Simpson of Simpson's Winery, and Ian from Ian Killett of Hambledon Vineyard. They really, you know, gave us the sort of seal of approval and their sound advice on what we should do, whether it was feasible. You know, of course, everything in the UK, the planting decision, the site selection is crucial. It has to be the right site. There are quite a multitude of factors that that have to be thought about before even going to the stage of planting. So being able to see that from day one, it's been fantastic. You know, we've got involved with the clonal selection, with where the vines are coming from, the rootstock choices, you know, all the sort of geeky stuff that we love, that's all been there. But also then bringing it back to a gateway or an entry into wine, it's also been a brilliant tool to just have a walk around the vineyard with a guest and bring them into our world of wine and then suggest the style that we will try and produce. So in a few years' time, we hope to take a crop of a really high quality fruit. You know, quality is the ultimate goal of this vineyard. We'd rather produce 100 bottles of something really that we're proud of than say, you know, 1,000 that we're sort of, you know, we're okay with, pat on the back. But no, we would love to do the best possible job we can. And we have the resources to be able to do that. You know, we have a big team and we'd love to get everyone involved. You know, we're just planning now the pruning for the winter pruning, get it, all the SOMs and our kitchen gardeners involved, and potentially doing a workshop with someone like, you know, Marco Simone of Simone & Circa, and look at some you know, contemporary pruning methods or gentle pruning methods. And then we're putting that calendar in place for next year. You know, can another team get involved in, say, the wire lifting or the leaf stripping, or, you know, all these jobs that happen throughout the year in a vineyard, getting that snapshot of the seasons. We can use those to our full advantage. And then, of course, there's the unknown of how the fruit will look next year. We hope to take a very small crop. Hopefully flowering and fruit set is a bit better than this year. And come sort of late September, October, we might take a small crop of, hopefully, fingers crossed, really good fruit. And we can then look to work with a winery somewhere in the UK and make a bit of a fun project. You know, it genuinely would be fantastic for any listeners that are interested in coming to see us, you know, purely to grab a bite to eat or a glass of wine. You know, it would be lovely to welcome those and come and see our vineyard. Slightly different take than most. It would be brilliant to engage with as many like-minded wine folk as possible. So, you know, do reach out and let's stay in touch.
A huge thank to Luke for being on the podcast and such a great guest. I really think your story will be inspiring to anybody who's working in hospitality. Please do help amplify this episode by sharing the direct link, which is interpretingwine.com/473. And you can also find the direct links to any of the four series episodes in the description below. Please do visit thepighotel.com, where you can learn more about the project and find their main social media handles. And do sign up for their mailing list to hear more news from the group, including the progress of their vineyard. Next time on the Interpreting Wine MW Student Series, in episode 474, we close the series in conversation with Florencia Gomez. So make sure you're subscribed to Interpreting Wine podcast wherever you're listening to be alerted when the episode goes live. See you then.